What do you remember from the class yesterday? Yes. What's his purpose in emphasizing this, the enmity so much? Isn't it? It is peculiar, isn't it? Looking at it from the point of view of devotional service. Why is he doing this? Because... But why is he emphasizing it? Because it's clearly pratikul. It's not in the line of devotional service. Why is he emphasizing it? Yeah, this was the... Practically speaking, what we're going to... We've heard beginning yesterday. It's a continuation of what we read in the third canto quite a few years ago. How the four Kumaras, when they had cursed Jayan Vijay, it was Jayan Vijay's desire when they were cursed to go to the material world. It was their desire to be fixed. They didn't mind being in the material world. Janmani, Janmani, Shvare, Bhavatad, Bhakti, Rahay, Tikitai. But their only desire was to be fixed in consciousness on Krishna. So this is the fulfillment of their desire. And oh, these two were so fixed for their three births each. They were so fixed in remembrance of Krishna. No other thought, practically speaking, could enter their consciousness. And why Narada Muni is emphasizing this? He's obviously not emphasizing their mood, their pratikul mood, which is unfavorable against and full of enmity or anger to the Lord, to Lord Vishnu, Lord Krishna. But he's really glorifying the positive. How wonderful it is to be that fixed in loving devotion to Krishna. Because when we examine our own consciousnesses, bahushaka, what does bahushaka mean? Yes, we have so many branches in our consciousness, and few of those branches really touch the lotus feet of Krishna at all. So he's not glorifying the mood of enmity, but he's glorifying the amazing amount of fixedness on Krishna that one can have through this mood. How amazing. They thought, practically speaking, of nothing else. So much that Kamsa, who is the example of what? Of fear. He's fear and bhaya. He was awarded because of his constantly thinking of Krishna, freedom. And I don't know if any of you have this experience, but when I'm angry at someone, no matter what I do, I can't get thoughts of them out of my mind. None of you have that problem, I'm sure. But oh, it fixes one so clearly. So what to speak ultimately of the residence of Vrindavan? What to speak of the residence of Vrindavan and the great devotees of the Lord who are so fixed due to their intense loving attachment and only wanting to please Krishna? So we've heard about the glories of this type of fixedness on Krishna in thought. And now we've begun to hear about Haranyakashipu. What was the question that brought this about? The final verse of Narada Muni, why was there such enmity between Haranyakashipu and his beloved son, Prahlad Maharaj? So there's a story that's going to be told. And this story is quite wonderful. And it is not going to emphasize the glory of enmity as it is going to emphasize the glory of the devotion of Prahlad, who was so fixed on his Lord that nothing could remove him. So what verse are we up to? What verse to begin with today? 11. 11. So up to this point, what is Hiranyakashipu? What is he doing? What has he started to do?
Pacifying his relatives.
That's what we'll be speaking about. But what's right? What have we gotten to prior to this? He's making his plans. Yes? And his plans, and this, there's such irony in this. It's so peculiar in a sense how we're hearing about this great demon, Hiranyakashipu, whose only thought, practically speaking, is his enmity towards Krishna. And we're going to hear about his terrible, nasty plans to give trouble to everyone in the universe and destroy culture. And what's the first thing he's going to do is preach. He's going to preach Bhagavad Gita only in honor of the Gita Jayanti. Bhagavad Gita is spoken today. Do we get to hear the Hiranyakashipu Gita? It's basic Bhagavad Gita, basically second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And this is what Hiranyakashipu is going to speak. Did anyone ask the question why? Of all the first words coming out of Hiranyakashipu's mouth, practically speaking, or amongst the first, this chapter, which is in one sense our introduction to Hiranyakashipu, this vicious demon, look how he's introduced. Is speaking very sweet and shastric words. Why has this introduction taken place in this way? What do we learn from that? Anyway, I'll ask this later. It's mentioned. There's one reason mentioned. But anyway, Hiranyakashipu Uvacha, he is continuing to speak over here in 11. The basic principle of Brahminical culture is to satisfy Lord Vishnu. Vishnu Dvija Kriya Moola. He is the root. He is the root of the culture, practically speaking. The personification, Vishnu, of sacrificial and ritualistic ceremonies. Lord Vishnu is the personified reservoir of all religious principles, and he is the shelter of all the demigods. It sounds as if he's glorifying Lord Vishnu. The great pittas, and the people in general. But then his motives, his actual thoughts begin coming from his mouth. When the Brahmins are killed, no one will exist to encourage the Kshatriyas to perform jagyas. And thus the demigods, not being appeased by jagya, will automatically die. So here is his plan, his great plan. He's going to stop the performance of jagyas, kill the Brahmins, destroy the demigods. And ultimately his goal is to kill Vishnu, to kill God. Of course, we know he cannot succeed in this plan. So therefore, we don't have to be in much anxiety. But just imagine this mentality. This is called asura bhav. This is the mentality of a demon. And there are only two kinds of mentalities in this world. There is the surat and the asurat. There is the devotional, the devotees, and the demonic. And all the conditioned souls, as innocent as we may appear, we all are little Hiranyakashipus, basically. We all have this type of a mood. We don't want Vishnu, Krishna, God to be in the center. And who do we want to be in the center? No, not you, me. And if you try to put yourself in the center, I will kill you. This is what's going on in the material world. Everyone points, yes, I want me in the center. And no one else is going to let you be in the center because everyone wants me in the center. And thus the material world goes on with its fighting, its enmity, its envy. This Hiranyakashipu attitude is the essence of material existence. It is not distant. It is everywhere in the material world, especially in Kali Yuga, where there is so little influence of Sattvagun, the mode of goodness. And he had a very well thought out plan, very, very pious. Since Vishnu, here's Srila Prabhupada's purport, since Vishnu is the central point of Brahminical culture, Hiranyakashipu's plan was to kill Vishnu. For if Vishnu were killed, naturally the Brahminical culture would also be lost. With Brahminical culture lost, jagyas will no longer be performed, and for want of jagya, the regular distribution of rainfall would cease. Thus there would be disturbance all over the world, and naturally the demigods would be defeated. From this verse we get a clear indication of how human society is disturbed when the Vedic Aryan civilization is killed and the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies performed by the Brahmins are stopped. Kalo Sudra Sambhava. Where is that from? I believe from the... 11th or 12th. Maybe Manusamita, possibly. Because the population of the modern world consists mostly of sudras. Why is everyone considered a sudra? Because everyone needs a master. Everyone needs to work for someone. No one is independent. No one has that spirit. Even the well-educated people, Prabhupada would compare them to dogs going with their degree. Their university degrees, their PhDs, and having to beg for a job somewhere. This is so demeaning for the consciousness and the spirit of man. It is demeaning, and it cuts down the tendency and the ability to strive for wonderful things. Because the population of the modern world consists mostly of sudras, the Brahminical culture is now lost and is extremely difficult to reestablish in a proper way. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya has recommended the chanting of the holy name of the Lord, which will revive Brahminical culture very easily. Why will it revive Brahminical culture? Chanting of the holy names?
Which process? Chanting the holy name?
Yes. And purifies it means what?
Purifies the heart from passion and ignorance.
Yes.
And when it comes to goodness.
Yes.
And can function in the Brahminical platform.
Yes. And what's the qualities of one on the Brahminical platform? Samo, tamas. Very, very exalted. Oh, how the lower modes of material nature, how they afflict us and give us trouble. These are the ornaments of everyone taking their birth born in Kali Yuga. We're afflicted by passion and afflicted by ignorance, and they disturb continuously our consciousness. Therefore, in Kali Yuga, Hariyanama, 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 three times. Eva Kevalam, there is no other way. Kevalam, there is no choice. That we need the shelter. Kalo, nasteva, 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 gati aniyata. There is no other way other than taking shelter of Krishna's names. And Mahaprabhu came. This is the external, not external, not in the sense of superficial, but this is the outward purpose of his coming. His advent is to establish the Yuga Dharma in his own special way and to make sure that all of his devotees take shelter of the holy names. And we have to know that there is nasteva, nasteva, nasteva. And the Bhagavatam will teach us this continuously. And if we miss it in the Bhagavatam, we'll certainly hear it in Prabhupada's purports. This is the shelter in Kali Yuga. And even if we perform some other process, and there are obviously so many other angas of devotional service, Navanga, Panchanga, Bhakti, but they all must be accompanied by chanting the holy names in Kali Yuga. There is no other way. The holy names must become our shelter. And as we read the Bhagavatam, we should keep in mind that these instructions that we're getting from the Bhagavatam and from the commentators, especially our Srila Prabhupada, they are meant for us and our application to be applied to our life. And here, specifically, we need the shelter of the holy names to become pure. Especially because the tendency of everyone is kalo sudra sambhava. Everyone is covered by the lower modes of material nature. Such tendencies are extremely deep. And again, they torture us. And if anyone has an aversion for being tortured, we have to know what our shelter is. And that is Krishna's holy names. Because of the increment, the increase in demoniac population, people have lost Brahminical culture, nor do people see the value of Brahminical culture. And we'll hear about this later, but in Brahminical culture, the Brahmins, established in the mode of goodness, they don't get involved so much in society, but rather they act as the head, the intelligence. That means they guide. And what is the specific guidance that they give? Of course, there are many different levels of their guidance, but the basic guidance is to make sure that society's direction, that it is carrying everyone, is upwards in spiritual life, towards loving service to Krishna. So without that head, without that intelligence, without that perspective in life, without the Brahminical perspective, what becomes the goal of society? Well, yeah, and look and specific. What is the most important thing if you're interested in sense gratification?
Money.
Money, yes, money. Without money, there's no honey. You can't do anything because Lakshmi Devi is Shakti. Without Shakti, without power, you cannot control. And without being able to control, you cannot enjoy. You cannot pull what you want closer and push what you don't want away. You need power for that. That's Lakshmi. That's money. So therefore, the purpose of society, stated directly and clearly, is economic development. This is the highest, most important thing. And what we wish to do on behalf of Srila Prabhupada is say, sorry, but it's not. Because the most important thing is to learn to love Krishna. It's not money, it's not sense gratification, it's love for Krishna. And you think everyone's going to say, oh, how wonderful, what a great idea this is, only if I had thought of it. No, people are going to become very angry. And we have to learn how to be fixed ourselves and challenge the very roots of materialistic society. That was actually Prabhupada's mood. He was so heavy, so heavy. And what was one of his favorite words? Rascal. Huh?
And
mudha, rascal, this, that, so-called civilization, soul-killing civilization. Because he was fixed in the realization of what life's actual purpose was, and how he saw how society was leading people astray. So now there is, nor is there a Kshatriya government. Instead, the government is a democracy in which any sudra can be voted into taking up the government reins and capture the power to rule. Because of the poisonous effects of Kali Yuga, the Shastra says, Dasyu Prayeshu Rajasu, the government will adopt the policies of Dasyus, or plunderers. Because they have the taxes, and they have the police and the army, and there's nothing you can do. When they want, we see this in Kazakhstan now, when they want your land, they have the law, they have the police, they have the army, and there's very little you can do. So they are plunderers. Thus there will be no instruction from the Brahmins, and even if there are Brahminical instructions, there will be no Kshatriya rulers who can follow them. Aside from Satyayuga, even formerly, and the days when demons were flourishing, Hiranyakashipu planned to destroy the Brahminical culture and the Kshatriya government, and thus create chaos all over the world. And the world, because what happens when the Brahmins are in control? People accept their lot in life because they see their life in the perspective of so many lives. And they see that now if I act in this way, okay, maybe my situation isn't so great, but okay, let me be satisfied. So these people get satisfied, and then I'll act in such a way that in the future, my lot can be better, even if I'm a materialist. But today, nobody is satisfied. Nobody is satisfied. Everyone is dissatisfied, angry because of the dissatisfaction, and blaming everyone else. Chaos in society, and it's going to get worse. It's getting worse, and it's going to get still worse, because the very root of society is materialism, and no one can be satisfied. And the more one tries to satisfy one's material desires that are born of passion, the more dissatisfied, and the more angry, and the more envious everyone becomes. And this is what's going on in the world, and all the plans made by the materialistic plan makers, they all fail because it's not based on spiritual truth and spiritual realization. So, although in Satyayuga this plan was very difficult to execute, in Kali Yuga, which is full of sudras and demons, the Brahminical culture is lost and can be revived only by the chanting of the Maha Mantra. And here is the hope of Srila Prabhupada. Therefore, the Krishna consciousness movement, or the Hare Krishna movement, has been inaugurated to revive Brahminical culture very easily, so that people may be happy and peaceful in this life and prepare for elevation in the next. So this puts great weight on devotees. What is the most basic weight? We can't say I'm going to change the world so much, but at least we should take advantage, take the medicine that we are prescribing for everyone else. At least we should do that. If we're saying that this is going to change the world, chanting Hare Krishna, we cannot just be an export business, meaning the exporter first takes some goods, and without doing anything himself with those goods, he just sends them somewhere else. I heard Prabhupada say that about book distribution and the transcendental knowledge of Krishna consciousness, that it is not an export business, it's meant for others. No, we have to take advantage of it ourselves. Not have to, in the sense we have no choice, but have to in the sense if we wish to fulfill Prabhupada's desire and the desire of Mahaprabhu, if we wish to take part in this, we have to take shelter of Krishna's holy names ourselves. Okay, text 12. So Haranyakashipu hears his plan being practically followed by his, or how he is instructed, and seeing how nasty, this is the demonic nature, it is nasty, it is selfish, and just as the Asura Bhav is described in the Bhagavad Gita, is he is my enemy, I have killed him. He is my other enemy, I have killed him. I am the controller, I am powerful, I am happy, I, me, me. Everything centers around me. So he was the enemy, Hiranyakashipu, being very powerful in a relative way. He made Brahminical culture, the demigods. If you make Vishnu your enemy, you automatically make the demigods and Brahminical culture enemy, and Hiranyakashipu had thrown down the gauntlet. Yes, these are my enemies. Vishnu is my enemy. He has killed my brother, and I will kill him, and I will destroy society. So immediately go wherever there is good protection for the cows and brahmanas, and wherever the Vedas are studied in terms of the Vanashrama principle. Set fire to those places and cut from the roots the trees there, which are the source of life. Important instructions here in Prabhupada's purports. Trees, protecting trees even. But Haranyakashipu continues. Thus the demons, being fond of disastrous activities, took Haranyakashipu's instructions on their heads with great respect and offered him obeisances. According to his directions, they engaged in envious activities directed against all living beings. The demons set fire to the cities, villages, pasturing grounds, cow pens, gardens, agricultural fields, and natural forests. They burned the ashrams, the hermitages of the saintly persons, the important mines that produce valuable metals, the residential quarters of the agriculturalists, the mountain villages, and the villages of the cow protectors, the coward men. They also burned the government capitals. Pretty nasty, huh? Listen to what else they did. I mean, they were demons. Their pleasure was giving difficulty to others. Some of the demons took digging instruments and broke down the bridges, the protective walls, and the gates of the cities. Some took axes and began cutting the important trees that produce mango, jackfruit, and other sources of food. Some of the demons took firebrands and set fire to the residential quarters of the citizens. These were the original terrorists that gave trouble to everyone. And their whole objective was to create chaos so no one would be able to follow any principles. Because when there's a chaotic, dangerous situation, what is on everyone's mind? Yeah. What? Save yourself? What's another, a word for it? Huh? Yeah. Survival. That's all people care about, is how am I going to save myself? Not all people. There are some people who, in the midst of a very difficult situation, they rise and become very selfless. They become great heroes and heroines because of their selflessness and bravery, even in the most difficult circumstances. And that actually, when there's a great disasters in the world, you can't stay in the middle. Either you go to this side and you become as nasty as everyone else, or you really go to this side and become very pure and selfless. You cannot stay in the middle. disasters and difficulty force people to one side or the other. Thus disturbed again and again by the unnatural occurrences caused by the followers of Aranyakashipu, all the people had to cease the activities of Vedic culture. They stopped because their only business was survival at that time. Not receiving the results of Jagya, the demigods also became disturbed. They left their residential quarters in the heavenly planets because they weren't, the whole system, they were actually trying to stop the entire Vedic culture based on the planning of Aranyakashipu, because his mood was to kill Vishnu and disrupt everything. So the demigods, unobserved by the demons, began wandering on the planet Earth to see the disasters. And they went to consider what to do. Now, not in this chapter, but a little later on, we shall hear their conclusions and what they did. Now, why didn't they just, demigods are more powerful than these little demons, why didn't they just stop it? All the cutting down of trees. Why didn't Indra just, every time someone tried to cut down a tree, a lightning bolt? Because Aranyakashipu was behind it. So they wanted to actually deal with Aranyakashipu himself, because he was the one who was the root of the problem. So after, now the story shifts. So this is what Aranyakashipu's mood is and how he's put his plan into action. Very nasty. After performing the ritualistic observances for the death of his brother, who was his brother? Aranyaksha. And what canto did we hear about the activities of Aranyaksha? Third canto. And what was told in relationship to that? Does anyone remember what was going on at that time? How we heard about it in the third canto? Yes, so that was mentioned just in a very short way, that he killed Hiranyaksha, that Lord Bor and Vrahadev killed Hiranyaksha. And then the question was asked, if I remember correctly, by Maharaj Prickett, then what was the cause of their enmity? And then what happens next in the Bhagavatam? What's described next? What was the cause of their enmity? The enmity between the Lord and Aranyaksha. That comes a little later. But then we hear how the four Kumaras go to Vaikuntha and the cursing of Jai and Vijay. And then we're understanding that Jai and Vijay, I think, yeah, first it starts with, Ditti. Anyway, gradually we move up to that. The pregnancy of Ditti by Kasyapa Muni at an inauspicious time. Then the four Kumaras go to Vaikuntha. And then the giant Vijay are cursed. And then we hear about that. And then the battle is resumed. We hear the description of how, in detail, of how Lord Bor killed Hiranyaksha. So, after performing the ritualistic observances for the death of his brother, Aranyakashipu, being extremely unhappy. Why was he unhappy? His brother had been killed by Vishnu in the form of a boar. He tried to pacify his nephews. Nephews means what? His brother's children. And also his brother's wife and his mother. O King, Aranyakashipu was extremely angry. But since he was a great politician, he knew how to act according to the time and situation. With sweet words, he began to pacify his nephews, whose name was Sakuni, Sambara, Dristi, Bhutana, son of Pana, Vrika, Kalanabha, Mahanabha, Haris, Masru, Utkach. He also consoled their mother, his sister-in-law, Rishabhanu, as well as his own mother, Ditti. He spoke to them all as follows. Now here, Haranyakashipu, that great sadhu, is going to preach. And he's, but what's, even though he's going to say the basic things that are in the Bhagavad Gita, what's wrong with his preaching? And just see, and the next chapter, he's going to completely do the opposite, because he's angry. He's telling them, these things that just happen according to fate, and the soul is for living forever, don't worry about anything, and all these material relationships, they come and they go. They're like straw being brought together in a river. And he's inside, he wants it, he's so angry at Vishnu for killing his brother. So what's wrong with his preaching?
It's hypocritical.
Yeah, and what's hypocritical mean? That's the first point. He has no interest in practicing what he's speaking. No integrity in that sense. No interest at all. Because sometimes we want to practice something that we preach or that we've read, but it's beyond our ability. But this isn't Haranyakashipu at all. He has no interest. His words are to fulfill some other purpose, his own purpose, not for application. So what is the rotten part of what he's doing? His motivation is wrong. Yes. His motivation is completely wrong for his words. So perhaps from this example, we should learn something that we have to be very careful of, is we have to be careful of our motivation. What is our purpose? What are we actually trying to accomplish by our activities in Krishna's service? What are we actually trying to accomplish? Is what we want to accomplish in harmony with what we are telling others? So this is a very, very personal topic, in a sense, because this is our business. This is our own business. To make sure, or not to make sure, but to bring our motives, our heart, our consciousness in line with our goal. And what we read, this is what it means to be aspiring devotees. We want to bring our consciousness, our motivation. We may not be expert in it. We may not be 100% pure or have the ability. But this should be our desire. Otherwise, there will be a Haranyakashipu living inside of us, that's waiting to kill Vishnu and place ourselves in the center. So Haranyakashipu begins his Haranyagita. My dear mother, sister-in-law, and nephews, you should not lament for the death of a great hero, for a hero's death in front of his enemy is glorious and desirable. This is right out of the Bhagavad Gita. You'll go to heaven, Arjuna, even if you lose in this battle. My dear mother, in a restaurant or place for drinking cold water, many travelers are brought together, and after drinking water, they continue to their respective destinations. If you've ever been on Indian trains, The people that you're a long train ride, you're traveling in a compartment with someone, and maybe you talk and talk and talk, and you make friendship with them and things like that. But as soon as you leave the compartment, it's finished. Has anyone had that experience?
Yes.
Of course. It's finished. Temporary getting together. What causes your reservation to meet with another person's reservation? Just the great computer in the sky. It's just chance, basically. So he's saying, many travelers are brought together by chance, practically speaking, and after drinking water, they continue to their respective destinations. Similarly, living entities join together in a family, and later, as a result of their own actions, they are led apart to their destinations. Everyone who shares the same compartment on the train, who goes to a restaurant and eats together, and who goes to a place where they're distributing water, everyone has their own separate individual karma and fate. So after the meeting together, we go our own ways. It's very heavy philosophy, actually. This is all jnana type of philosophy that is meant to breed detachment from the material world and renunciation from the material world. Because the cause of our miseries are attachment in the material world, and therefore the jnani and the jnana type of preaching is meant to cause renunciation. But this, although useful in bhakti, especially in the beginning, really is not at bhakti's heart at all. Jnaniat asu vairagyam. The jnana and the vairagya comes quickly and automatically if one gets param dvisva navartate, the higher taste in bhakti, visha vinivartante nirarasya deinam. But yet, this presentation is important for us. Because we're moving onward in the Bhagavatam, and we get into more esoteric and more wonderful topics. There's going to be less description of the creation. In the sixth canto, we heard the glories of the holy name, and eventually we get to the eighth canto and the ninth canto, where just the ninth canto, there's right before we hear about Krishna, the ninth canto, and there's an endless succession of little stories about kings and how this generation and then this one came and this one came and this one came and this one had five sons and one of those five sons had seven sons and one of those seven sons had two sons and one was did this and one did, and on and on and on, just to bring us to the point of understanding that we too will pass. We too will die, and our children will die, and their 10 children will also die. And no matter how they succeed, they just become a name in history. And that type of renunciation is required. That type of detachment is required, because we have to let go of those things on the material level that we're attached to, so we can hold on tightly to the lotus feet of Krishna. So therefore, although in one sense this is it's a step to the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, still we should listen very carefully, and Prabhupada, his purports are very, very strong. And he, even though it doesn't seem from the verses that Hiranyakashipu wants to get into any points of bhakti specifically, but Prabhupada and the other acharyas, they always bring Krishna in, because this is actually the instruction of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in how to describe the Bhagavatam, how to speak on the Bhagavatam. Always make it lead directly to Krishna. Always bring Krishna in. Always bring Krishna in. Who did Mahaprabhu tell that to? Does anyone know? When Devananda Pandit, he asked Mahaprabhu, because he was a big, big, big scholar, but an impersonalist. And then after Mahaprabhu took sannyas, and Mahaprabhu was very critical of him because he wasn't a devotee, but yet he was speaking on the Bhagavatam. So after Mahaprabhu took sannyas, Devananda Pandit had the association of Vikesha Pandit. And by the mercy of Vikesha Pandit, Devananda Pandit became appreciated Mahaprabhu and understood who he was. So therefore, he asked Mahaprabhu, even though he was the best scholar in Navadvipa, practically speaking, he asked Mahaprabhu, how should I speak on the Bhagavatam? What should I do? I don't know anything. Superficially, I know so much. But actually, I know nothing of the purport, of the purpose of the Bhagavatam. Mahaprabhu told him that he should describe Krishna and Krishna only when he speaks, and then your speaking will be perfect. So, of course, I would love to read these purports. I'll just read one little part of what Prabhupada said. Although Hiranyakashipu was a demon, he had Vedic knowledge. It's not possible for someone to become so powerful like Hiranyakashipu is powerful and be without knowledge. Because what's the next thing he's going to do also? He's going to preach basic Vedic philosophy, and then he's going to perform great austerities, so different from the little demons of today. For the little demons of today, they think I'll do everything with my own power. So arrogant. And because of arrogance, they cannot actually even become big demons. They have to remain forever little demons. But Hiranyakashipu was the real thing. He was empowered by the Lord practically to be a demon. So he was a great demon. So Hiranyakashipu was a demon. He had Vedic knowledge and understanding. Thus the advice given to his family members, his sister-in-law, mothers and nephews, was quite sound. The demons are considered highly elevated in knowledge, but because they do not use their good intelligence for the service of the Lord, they are called demons. So the cutting point of divine and demoniac is very simple and very clear. And it is, who are you working for? Who do you serve? Do you serve yourself or do you serve Krishna? Did you ever ask yourself that question? Who are you serving? But you have to do it in private, when no one can listen or watch which side of the line you go to. But if we see that we're not actually true servants of Krishna, then we consider ourselves aspiring for that and become humble, and we should lament at our fallen condition. So Hiranyakashipu is going to speak further. Great philosophy. The spirit soul, the living entity, has no death. What's the Bhagavad Gita verse? For he is eternal and inexhaustible. That's one. Najayate miyate va kadachin. Another one. So there are many. We could take out our Bhagavad Gitas. Being free from material contamination, he can go anywhere in the material or spiritual worlds. He's Sarvagataha. He is fully aware and completely different from the material body. But because of being misled by misuse of his slight independence, he is obliged to accept subtle and gross bodies created by the material energy and thus be subjected to the so-called material happiness and distress. Therefore, no one should lament for the passing of the spirit soul from the body. We should lament our misuse of independence, which entangles us in this temporary situation. Karanam guna sangasya sada sat joni janmasu. What's the beginning of that verse? Purusha prakriti stoli bhunte prakriti jalaya. The living entity is born in different families or species of life because of being infected by the modes of material nature. That means each and every one of our births in our own families, in our own country, with our own nature and the particular bodies that we happen to inhabit is due to the infection of desires from our previous life. Pious and impious. So what should we consider? That we should be very careful how we live this life. Otherwise we have to do it all again. Because of the movement of water, here's an example. The trees on the bank of a river. Now you have to think of this in your mind, what it means. Because of the movement of the water, so the water in a river is moving. The trees on the bank of a river, when reflected on the water, seem to move. Yes? The water is moving, and you see the reflection of the trees on the moving water, and it appears as if the trees are moving, even though trees obviously are not moving. Similarly, when the eye moves, the eyes move because of some mental derangement, the land appears to move also. And the next verse goes with this one. In the same way, O my gentle mother, in other words, your eyes are moving, but the land isn't moving. The water is moving, and it makes it appear that the trees are moving, even though the trees aren't moving. In the same way, O my gentle mother, when the mind is agitated by the movement of the modes of material nature, the living entity, although freed from all the different phases of the subtle and gross bodies, he thinks he has changed from one condition to another. We have nothing to do with the body. We have nothing to do, and that's one thing. We can easily, not easily maybe, but at least we can theoretically accept that we are different from our body. But when it comes to thinking that we are different from our mind, much more difficult. It's easier to think we are different from our body because I remember when I was young, 13 years old, there was a completely different body that I used to look at when I looked in the mirror. It was completely different from the one I see looking back at me now. But I'm the same person, so it's simple, at least theoretically, to accept that I'm not the body, but the mind. Every fluctuation of the mind, I am happy, I am angry, this person I don't like, this person is this, this is good, this is bad. Just depending upon the mind's fluctuations. So the mode of passion just makes us go round, up and down, and up and down, and up and down, up and down, because it moves the mind in so many different directions, and it causes so much trouble in that way. And we're so foolish. That we lament and because of the identification of something temporarily there in a whole series of movements. So Haranyakasipu's point is that this person who you're all lamenting for, you foolish people, he was with you for a short time as your son, as your husband, as your father, but now he's gone on. But he is the same. And you're foolishly lamenting. He's already passed to his next destination. In his bewildered state, the living entity accepting the body and mind to be the self, he considers some people to be his kinsmen, others to be outsiders. If you meet someone from your own country, immediately you feel close to them. Others, different country, outsiders. Because of this misconception, identification with the body and mind, he suffers. This is the cause of our suffering. It's something internal. Haranyakasipu's words are true. Indeed, the accumulation of such concocted material ideas is the cause of suffering and so-called happiness in the material world. The conditioned soul thus situated must take birth in different species and work in various types of consciousness, thus creating new bodies. And this continued material life is called samsara. Birth, death, lamentation, foolishness, and anxiety are due to such material considerations. Thus, we sometimes come to a proper understanding and sometimes fall again into a wrong conception of life, all on the material level, all due to misidentification. And thus, we suffer. This is actually, even though it's coming from Hiranyakashipu's lotus-like mouth, it is still the cause of our suffering. He's correct. In this regard, now he's going to tell a story, because it's helpful. Stories are helpful. In this regard, an example is given from an old history. Puratanam, itihasam, puratanam. This involves a discourse between Yamaraj and the friends of a dead person. Please hear it attentively. So all, there's going to be a story that he tells of who? Who is, raise your hand if you've read ahead. Who's read this already? Who's, do you remember? What the story is about that he's going to tell?
Suyagya.
Yeah. And they were all lamenting because he was a warrior. He was killed. Yeah. So attached. And then that's so funny. And there's one little sentence Prabhupada put. The Matajis, his wives, were clinging to him. Oh, we love you so much. We cannot let you go. We won't let them take you and burn you. And then there's one little sentence. They were afraid of having to enter the fire themselves. In the midst of all the love and everything, there was a little bit of selfishness in there. Which is always the case in the material world. It's not. There's no pure love in this world. And what masks as love is this kind of selfishness. Always. Beneath the surface is always something self-motivated in materialistic relationships. Love is so hard to find in the material world. And therefore, we have to hear about these things, because love based on the body is not love at all. And we have to give up this conception if we want to understand something about what real love is, because in the 10th canto, the highest pinnacle of real love is going to be described. The selfless love of the residents of Vrindavan, especially the Braja Gopis, but all the residents of Vrindavan. And it doesn't have the slightest tinge of this type of selfishness. And because, practically speaking, we have no conceptions of this, all we can do is hear about it. But with the right conception, because that type of love, different from this kind of love, brings ecstasy, the highest kind of ecstasy. And this kind of love, based on the material conceptions, just brings one variety of suffering after the next, with up and down and up and down, little pleasure, some suffering, pleasure, suffering. If it was all suffering, you'd get used to it. But it doesn't work like that. It's like this, like this. It's like roller coaster. Raise your hand if you've been on a roller coaster when you were young. Yes, only Americans are allowed to, are that foolish, to go on roller coasters. En France, no?
Yes.
Yes, but...
Yes.
But you never went on one? Yes? Did you enjoy? It's crazy! It's terrifying! And the people, and they get the... And what they love, they go around, up and down and around, turn, and they scream! Because they're so afraid. It's terrifying. This is the pleasure. So if you want to taste that kind of fruit, taste that kind of pleasure, then all you have to do is cultivate the mode of passion in this world, and you'll experience the roller coaster of life. It's up and it's down, and people love you, and then they hate you, and then this great success comes, and then this great failure comes, and up and down, and up and down. You're happy, you're miserable, and you're happy and you're miserable. Up and down. She loves me, she hates me. Up and down. I'm rich, I'm poor, I'm rich, I'm poor. Ah. That's what passionate material existence is like. And the only thing for the current population that takes the edge of all this up and down, that allows them to tolerate all this suffering as they become intoxicated, practically speaking. They can't live without drinking, without smoking, without the intoxication of the television, of the movies, so they don't have to think about their life. So this is contemporary civilization. This Hiranyakashipu was successful. Through Kali, he was successful. So here's the history. And it's interesting because there's a real Bhagavatam speciality, because who is speaking? On the outsider's level. Huh? Sutta is speaking and telling what Sukadeva is telling Maharaj Prakrit. And inside of that, based on the question that Maharaj Prakrit asked Sukadeva Goswami, then Maharaj Yudhisthira is asking Narada a question. And in an answer to that, Hiranyakashipu is preaching to the his relatives. And there's a story inside that about the Suyajana, and where Yamaraj is going to come, and Yamaraj is going to tell a story inside of that of some birds. So it's stories inside of stories inside of stories inside of stories inside of stories. So in the state known as Usinar, there was a celebrated king named Suyajna. When the king was killed in battle by his enemies, his kinsmen sat down around the dead body and began to lament the death of their friend. Raise your hand if you have seen the dead body of either a dear friend or a relative very close to you. Yeah. It's heavy. Why is it heavy? Because who you think they are is right there. When you see a picture of that person, you say, oh, I know him, that's my friend, that's my mother, that's my sister, that's my this, my that. But the body is there. But the person that you love is not there. It's a shock to the system. Clearly, and this will be explained, clearly the person's gone. But the body is there. The body is there and the person isn't there. So the king, Suyajna, his golden bejeweled armor smashed, his ornaments and garlands fallen from their places, his hair scattered and his eyes lusterless. Why were his eyes lusterless? He was gone. The doors were closed. There was no one home. The king lay on the battlefield, his entire body smeared with blood, his heart pierced by the arrows of the enemy. When he died, he had wanted to show his prowess, his strength, and thus he had bitten his lips, and his teeth remained in that position. His beautiful lotus-like face was now black and covered with dust from the battlefield. His arms, with his sword and other weapons, were cut and broken. When the queens of the king of Usinara saw their husband lying in that position, they began crying, O Lord, now that you have been killed, we also have been killed. There's no purpose to my life. That's what they're feeling, because you are gone. Repeating these words again and again, they fell down, pounding their breasts at the feet of the dead king. So Prabhupada explains in a short purport that his biting his lip means that he desired to show his strength, but his own power was no protection at all. That is all our situation. As the queens loudly cried, their tears glided down their breasts, becoming reddened by kumkum powder. and fell upon the lotus feet of their husband. Their hair became disarrayed, their ornaments fell. And in a way that evoked sympathy from the hearts of others, the queen began lamenting their husband's death. It sounds like a movie. Huh? Hindi movie, yes. Oh Lord, this is what they said, you have now been removed by cruel providence to a state beyond our sight. You had previously sustained the livelihood of the inhabitants of Usinara, and thus they were happy. But your condition now is the cause of their unhappiness. O King, O hero, you are a very grateful husband and the most sincere friend of us all, of all of us. How shall we exist without you? O hero, wherever you are going, please direct us there so that we may follow in your footsteps and engage again in your service. Let us go along with you. The time was appropriate for the body to be burned, but the queens, not allowing it to be taken away, continued lamenting for the dead body which they kept on their laps. In the meantime, the sun completed its movements for setting in the west, because in the Vedic culture, the same day, if a death occurs during the day, the body should be burned by night. By the time the sun sets, the body should be alit with fire. And if there's a death at night, as soon as the sun rises in the morning, the body should be taken away and burnt, because the soul attached to the body, along with this gross body, for all materialistic persons, because of the attachment, it doesn't allow him to leave, go on to his next life, and that keeps him in a ghostly situation and suffering. And of course, here's Prabhupada's last sentence in the purport. Apparently, the queens did not want to deliver the dead body for burning because they were afraid of dying with the dead body of their husbands. Isn't that so cute and subtle? How all their words are one thing, but what's in their mind is something different. Are they hypocrites? Remember, if you condemn them, you are condemning also yourself and myself too. This is the tendency of a materialist, of a material conditioned soul. Has to be self-centered. That's what false ego means. That is what Maya means. That is what illusion means. Means self-centered. And therefore the doorway to bhakti is sharanagati, surrender, which means placing Krishna in the center. When the queens were lamenting for the dead body of the king, their loud cries were heard even from the abode of Yamaraj. Where is the abode of Yamaraj? It's right down above, right above the Govardhaka ocean, if you remember from the fifth canto. So their loud cries were heard from the abode of Yamaraj, thousands of miles away. Assuming the body of a boy, Yamaraj personally approached the relatives of the dead body and advised them as follows. Prabhupada speaks it very... Preta Bandhunam, the friends and relatives of the dead king. What he says here, of the dead body, the relative of a dead body, the friend of a dead body. He's gone. The soul is gone. And we hold on to the dead body. So Yamaraj personally approached the relatives of the dead body and advised them as follows. So Yamaraj said, "Alas, how amazing it is." So he's a young boy. He's speaking a young boy here. "How amazing it is. These persons who are older than me have full experience that hundreds and thousands of living entities have taken birth and died, died. Thus they should understand that they also are apt to die. Yet still They are bewildered. The conditioned soul comes from an unknown place. We don't know where we came from, how we got here, and returns after death to that same unknown place. We don't know where we go. And that is the fear of death. There is a great unknown. The known that I have here, even though it's maybe quite difficult, is preferable to the unknown, the great unknown place. There is no exception to this rule. What verse? Second chapter? For one who has taken his birth, death is certain. It is certain. That means it's certain for me, for you, 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 for you. I missed you, I think. All of us. Did I miss anyone? Okay. Yes, Prabhu. It's so funny. Only in the Krishna Consciousness Movement, I just told everyone they're going to die and they're laughing. Okay. There is no exception to this rule, which is conducted by material nature. Knowing this, why do they uselessly lament? Why lament for something that is inevitable? And Prabhupada in his purport, I'm skipping the purports because I've spoken a lot and the purports are a bit long, but please read them carefully. They're very wonderful and powerful preaching by Prabhupada and the purport here to 37. So, why lament for, how could you lament for the soul which is eternal? Or on the other hand, as the Bhagavad Gita explains, if you think that the body is the self, why lament for chemicals that are going to be dispersed? So either way, there's no cause of lamentation. What need is there for lamentation? It is wonderful, Yamaraj is speaking sarcastically, but it is amazing that these elderly women do not have a higher sense of life than we do, than I do. I'm a baby, practically speaking, just a young boy, and I understand these principles, and these, they're adults, they're experienced, and they don't understand. Indeed, we are most fortunate. For although we are children, we have been left to struggle in material life, unprotected by father and mother. And although we are very weak, we have not been vanquished or eaten by ferocious animals. Thus we have a firm belief that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has given us protection even in the womb of the mother, will protect us everywhere. The Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is such an interesting point that they were lamenting that who will protect us, our great protector, has died. And Yamaraj is saying, what I used to think was my misfortune, that I grew up without my parents, no one to protect me, now I see it is my great fortune, because I've learned that despite my protectors not being present, because the parents are naturally the protectors of the child, still I was protected. And this is very important for devotees to understand on a very deep level. If we list all the reasons we're unfortunate, we will come up with a great list. But we will see actually that throughout all our misfortunes, and the misfortunes come from what? Really, that's our karma, our fate due to previous activities. And Yamaraj himself is explaining this. We're unfortunate in so many ways, but out of the misfortune, if we properly hear from Shastra, the greatest understanding of our fortune can be born. And if that is born from our so-called misfortune, to understand something about Krishna, to understand that all along He's been protecting us. As He protected us in the womb, He protected us when we were growing up, He's protected us when we were young, and now, even as we're old, we're getting older, He's protecting us. So from that feeling of being protected can come placing ourselves under His protection. And placing oneself under the protection of Krishna is called saranagati, gotapte varanam tata, becoming a devotee. So therefore Prabhupada, at the end of this purport, says, one who does not abide by the orders of the Supreme Personality, or a little bit high before that, the sentence before, the Lord says, sarvadamam pratyaja mamekam sharanam braja. Give up all other duties and simply surrender unto me. One who does not abide by this order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is given the facility to enjoy this material world. Instead of restricting him, the Lord gives the conditioned soul the opportunity to enjoy, so that by mature experience, after many, many births, bahunam dharmanamante, he will understand that surrender to the lotus feet of Vasudeva is the only duty of all living beings. So the boy, Yamaraj, continued to address the women. O weak women, only by the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we'll take a break at 12, Krishna willing. Only by the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is never diminished, is the entire world created, maintained, and again annihilated. Icha yeshaha, only by His will, His desire. This is the most heavy, in one sense, of very simple statements, that nothing can happen without being sanctioned by the Lord, Upadrashta Anumanta. Without Krishna's desire, allowing it to happen, nothing happens. This is the verdict of the Vedic knowledge. This material creation consists of the moving and non-moving. It's exactly like His plaything. Being the Supreme Lord, He's completely competent to destroy and protect. This purport is quite interesting. In this regard, the queens might argue, if our husband was protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead when in the womb, why has he not been given protection now? So you can place your own question in there instead of the queen's question, your own personal question. If Krishna, if I'm a devotee and if Krishna is in control and He's always protecting everyone, why? To this question, the answer is ya itchayesha srijatidam avyayo ya evirakshati avalumpate chaya. One cannot argue with the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord is always free. And whatever He can, and therefore He can protect, and all can also annihilate. He is not our order carrier, and whatever He likes, He will do. Therefore, He is the Supreme Lord, not me. The Lord does not create this material world at anyone's request, and therefore He can annihilate everything merely by His will. That is His supremacy. If one argues, why does He act in this way? Raise your hand if you sometimes, that thought, what are you doing? You should take some management classes or something. If one argues, why does He act in this way? The answer is that He can do so because He's the Supreme. He is independent. He does as He likes. No one can question His activities. You like this concept? If one argues, what is the purpose of this sinful creation and annihilation? Why does He? What's the purpose behind all this? The answer is that to prove His omnipotence, He can do anything and no one can question Him. So that's the idea. We are not the Supreme. And we can't question him, not in the sense that we can't ask these questions, but we can't bring him to our sense of justice or anything like that. He is the Supreme. He can do as he's like. He is independent, and there's no one else in existence who is independent other than him. And we don't like it, so we have to come to the material world, entrapped by false ego, and try to manage the entirety of existence. And we fail, because we are not the Supreme Lord. If he were answerable to us concerning why he does something and why he does not, his supremacy would be curtailed. So, the line is very strict. You're an atheist or a theist. You're going to give yourself or attempt to give yourself to Krishna, or you want to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead and do a better job than him. And if you want to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead and do a better job than him, then you get your whole, your own universe in which you are the Supreme, and the whole, everything in existence revolves around you. And the only problem is that no one will accept that you're the Supreme. And there's nothing you can do about it. So, Krishna willing, in a few moments, at 12:30, we'll return. We'll have a break for a half hour. And Krishna willing, we'll get up to text 16.